a lot of the reason that Intel's here is that literally every time we engage with a customer outside, they want to know about OpenOffice. They're using OpenOffice, or they're customizing OpenOffice. It's just the basis of the spread of open source software into the developing world, because they don't have broadband yet. So, you know, all of the fine client server stuff or server-based stuff that has been driving open source in North America and Europe sort of doesn't matter as much yet in the developing world. So desktop is where they're starting. And I never read my slides, so you guys go ahead and read them. And if you have questions, ask as we go along, because I'll try to leave room at the end, but it often happens that there isn't much room at the end. Okay, I left this slide in here. The last time I used this stack, I was at FOSSAP, which is the meeting we were at in Cambodia. I left this here because that was a very interesting meeting for me from the perspective of listening to 22 different country representatives telling their stories. And there was a range of experience from people who had successfully pushed a government in a certain direction, like Javier has done, NGOs, people that worked in universities, people who were just starting, people who had failed. There were a fair number of "we tried and this is where we failed" sort of failure analysis stories. But these were the big themes that I heard over and over again. And they were interesting. The number one thing I heard was about diversity, which is surprising, and maybe I listen for it extra carefully now. The other thing that's happened in the last 6 months is I've somehow become the poster girl for women in open source. And it's always been something that's interesting to me. I was hearing a lot about diversity at the UN level, right? I heard a lot about ethics, and the ethics of using open software without giving back, the ethics of using open software as a bargaining chip for proprietary companies and whether that was a reasonable thing to do. Governments who were being forced to be more transparent and what that did to the sort of morals and ethics of the country. So I want you guys to understand one of the things that I believed before I left Sun, but I now really believe, is that, oh look, what's that for? What I now really believe is that open source is not just about software. It's not just about the stuff that we're building. I believe that it's a fundamental shift in the way that intellectual property is approached. And I think we're going to see that ripple through the next, who knows how long, you know, 20, 30 years. It feels to me like the way that the ecology movement felt when I was a kid. And some of you have heard me say that before. When I was a kid in America, recycling, taking your old bottles in and giving them to somebody to reuse was like an act of rebellion. It was you had to go way out of your way to do it. It was really inconvenient. And it wasn't clear that it was saving anybody anything. But a few people did it, and a lot of people talked about it. And now, 30 years later, in America, literally every city requires recycling. Because all those people that were my age grew up and got jobs in governments and pushed rules that made that reality that they wanted when they were kids really happen. And I think that's one of the things that's going to happen in this revolution as well. Attribution for work came up repeatedly, partly because Richard Stallman was there, and he kept saying, "You really ought to give me credit. You really ought to say GNU Linux, you know, right?" But It was interesting to the people that were talking as well. They seemed to believe that the people who write software should get attribution. The people who write open content should get attribution. And I found that interesting because in the open source licensing world, that's sort of not okay. Required attribution is really an interesting problem. Famously, the University of California was pressured by the BSD community to give up its required attribution. And on OSI, I should have said, in addition to working for Intel and having worked for Sun, I'm also on the OSI board, which means that I work in the group of people that are trying to sort out the licensing issues around open source and to providing a standard for what is the term open source, what does it mean. And I've been doing that work since 2001. And when we talk about attribution in that forum, we almost always reject it because our sort of direct North American developer base have told us that that's not something that they want to see in the licensing. And yet I kept hearing about it, which I thought was interesting. And professionalism, very big deal to these people. They want to be taken seriously. These are people who are trying to change their countries at a fundamental level. I think this is one of the reasons that in some markets the free software message delivery mechanism isn't working so well. Not the message. The message is compelling, but when it's being delivered by people who look like they've never actually, you know, held a professional job, it's hard for the people in positions to make change to take that in. And one of the pieces of advice I keep giving the Free Software Foundation and the Free Software Movement is start finding spokesmodels who are who clean up the way that politicians need to see people clean up in order to take them seriously. It's a silly game, but it's important. And I, at this meeting, I suggested to Richard that perhaps a new mascot is in order. And he did okay with it, I thought. I was surprised. All right. So, the truth about why proprietary companies engage in open source. This is instructive to the developing world. The truth is, any big company, any existing proprietary company that engages in open source is doing it to disrupt a market, period. There is no altruism in because they can't be altruistic. They're publicly traded companies. In America, that means they must maximize profit. So they're not doing things because they're nice guys. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't good people in the company, and that doesn't mean that some individuals aren't working from that heart space. But the company is definitely after the market and a way to make the market work to their advantage. They are also responding to customer demand, and that's a big reason why Intel's in this game now. You know, companies that are successful in the model that they're using and are making a lot of profits or consistently making profits, if they start looking at change, you've got to realize that it's probably customer demand that's driving it, right? And that's definitely what's happening. And what that means for developing countries is if you can mobilize your demand in the direction you think things ought to go, the companies will listen to you, right? So in that respect, using open source as a way to bargain with proprietary companies, maybe that is a reasonable and ethical thing to do. I'd rather see you argue in the direction of being self-deterministic about your software, personally, but that's my choice, you know, you get to choose. It's important to realize that I get in conversations from countries that are trying to build their own economic model around technology, like domestic technology. They get very upset, some of them, when we talk about open source because they think it assumes that there's no value in the stack anymore and they can't make money on software the way that North America did. Right, and unfortunately, there probably won't be a Chinese Bill Gates. I'm not sure that you want us, you know, the richest person in your world to be making their money off of software anyway. I mean, we sort of ran that experiment. You can see what happens when you do that. But additionally, the conditions are different than they were. I mean, it is true that right now in the developing world, bandwidth is a problem. It's not going to take as long to fix that problem as it did in North America because it was a technical problem before and now it's just a distribution problem. So because that's going to happen faster, there won't be as much time to bake a market so that productivity suite can gain the foothold that it did. And I mean, there's lots of problems with the assumption that you could run the same experiment and get the same outcome. People who are economists in North America who look at open source are saying, well, what's really happening here is just a cycle. So, you know, the stack was closed, the stack is sort of being forced open by the market because it's happening, whether the companies like it or not, they're being forced to play at this point because their customers are telling them they have to. So it's forcing the market open, but what's really happening is the value in the software stack is just moving to different places now in the stack. And so the good news is if you're a developer or a country trying to create a technology economy, there are different places in the stack that you can build on, and you don't have to repeat the thing that just happened for the last 20 years. And I think it's always going to be this way. I think in another 10 years, we'll be looking at parts of the stack that were built out now as proprietary,
because there was no market incentive for them to be open. And we'll be pushing them open, and there'll be new stuff happening. I think it's always going to be that way. So you can still make money on software. You just may not be able to make, you know, ridiculous money, but you can totally make living money. And you know, that's another interesting thing about the difference between developing countries and developed countries. The big companies that are being shaken by this movement have realities about the way their economies work based on the money they could make in the last decade. And they're either going to shrink, or they're going to get more efficient, or they're going to look for new ways to make money. They have to do something in this new economy. Okay. Ah, this is an Intel slide. So on our left, we have Mr. Moore, who said that the chip was going to get faster every 18 months, right? It doubles every 18 months. Then we have Metcalf, who said the net gets faster. This is sort of, it's getting faster, it's getting faster. Interestingly enough, Moore's Law, every so often, Slashdot tells us that Moore's Law has petered out, and then Gordon gets out there and goes, no, I don't think so, not yet. So, and I think all the chip manufacturers would tell you that speed is going to continue. You know, I grew up on Star Trek. I'm hoping for a computer that just is in the room that I can talk to. That would be cool. But it's going to obviously require a lot more computational power than we have now. The interesting thing is that Intel's now looking at open source as a trend comparable with these two major trends that informed the industry and the choices that they made. Now, that doesn't mean, for those of you who are studying up on the fact that we also do a lot of work in Redmond, that doesn't mean that we're abandoning our traditional fellow travelers. What it does mean is we're looking very seriously at this segment because it seems to be creating a sea change. And frankly, you know, Sun thought that as well, right? I think a lot of the big companies do. In fact, I started saying a couple of years ago, I believe Microsoft will figure this out and will become a player in the open source space, and one that plays in a way that we can all live with, because I think that the space requires them to behave a certain way. It'll be interesting to see how that happens. They are a smart company, they have a lot of resources, and I think it's inevitable that they'll sort it out. It's just up to us to hold a line so that they, you know, get how the new game is played. When I say us, I mean the open source community, not Intel. Okay. This backs up the open source market trend. This is data from various analyst organizations that have looked and are saying, my gosh, a lot of Linux boxes are shipping. This is how Intel came to the decision to go ahead and look at open source delivery in addition to the existing delivery mechanisms that we were supportive of. And to be clear with everybody, Intel doesn't sell software for profit. What we sell is the chips that make computers run. And the truth is, we're a huge beneficiary of the open source movement without doing anything, because most open source software ships up boxes that run Intel. But we would like to go the extra mile to make sure that delivery of open source on our platform is the best experience that it can possibly be. Increasingly, in the developing world, where I spend my time now, the choice that the customer is making is to go towards the open source stack. And they're making that choice before we show up. We don't try to sell them on that idea. They come to us and say, okay, we want to give our citizenry 1 million PCs, as they said in China, and we'd like it to be an open source stack. Can you help make this work well on your chipset? And of course we say yes. This is functionally what my group does. We do that last mile enabling to make sure that those are very positive experiences. And we do it because of this, period, right? So the good news is open source has grown to the point as a phenomenon where a cold hard cash company like Intel cannot ignore it because of this and because of customer demand. And again, the developing world can use this information, right? Okay, so here's a little recap on why people need technology, and you can read it. I don't have to read it to you. Functionally, you all know this, but in fact, technology companies stopped knowing this at some point in maybe the mid-80s or the early 90s. They stopped knowing that people were trying to solve problems, and instead they started telling them what they wanted. Hey, you, the customer, you want to upgrade. You want to upgrade, and you want to give us more money. this became the way things were done. And I think what happened with open source in the developing world was basically bad planning on the part of the proprietary software industry, because a repricing moment happened starting about a year and a half ago. A lot of the really long-term payment agreements or licensing agreements that were in place with really large customers, big governments, expired at exactly the moment when an acceptable alternative was made available. Right? Now, remember a few slides ago I said market disruption is the reason big companies do things. When OpenOffice was shipped, it was absolutely a market disruption move. And in fact, I think they were pretty upfront about the fact, Sun was pretty upfront about the fact that that was one of the motivators. There were others. They had a platform that they needed to provision because there needs to be productivity on Unix in order for Solaris to do well, and there was no good productivity suite that was affordable. So that was also a problem they were solving. But it didn't hurt any that they were in the middle of a lawsuit with the major proprietary desktop provider, right? Luckily, in the developing world, those kinds of Clash of the Titans moves just create opportunity. Open source is really about opportunity for the developing world. And lucky for them, it happened to coincide with the time when availability of technology became desirable for a whole bunch of governments. They wanted to start provisioning their citizenry with technology, and acceptable alternatives showed up. So, you know, it's a perfect moment of timing. So when we talk to the developing world and we talk to everybody, these are the reasons, and these are in ranked order, the reasons that they're choosing to ask us to make open source work for them. Notice the number one reason is not price. Much has been made of the fact that price, total cost of ownership, is the driving force, and there's been a lot of energy put in on the part of the proprietary world to debunk the myth that open source software is cheaper. They talk a lot about total cost, they talk about cost of support, lots of other things. You guys have heard all of this. The truth is, in the developing world, they know the difference between the hype and reality. They know that they can just download it and it doesn't cost anything to acquire versus they have to pay a licensing fee somewhere. But in a lot of the developing world, the licensing fee they're paying is not really a licensing fee, it's a piracy fee. They're paying like $2 a copy or $1 a copy or, you know, some ridiculously small amount for an illegal copy. Part of what's driving this change is that a lot of the developing world has signed World Trade Organization agreements just recently, just in the last 2 years. And one of the conditions of World Trade Organization agreement around the world is that you end piracy of software and you start holding sacred the notion, the Western notion of intellectual property. So right after you sign your agreement, ESA shows up with audit requests for all the large organizations in your country. And if too many of them are not playing fair with licensing, you're in contempt of trade. Oops, you're embargoed, you've got a big problem. So there is a very big interest in the developing world around this question, and also in the developed world, right? But piracy is much more pervasive, especially in Asia. It just hasn't been an issue for them for a really long time. They feel differently about it than we do in the West. It's important to point out that for most of the 18th century, America, North America as a country, did not recognize the copyrights of non-Americans. So we were rampantly infringing on Charles Dickens copyrights, on, you know, any popular culture that came from Europe. We copied it. We didn't care. And it was judged at the time that that was a reasonable stance to take because our country needed to be built. And so it's a little disingenuous of us now to tell the developing world that that's an inappropriate response, I think. A lot of people who think that. Nevertheless, these agreements are being signed, and they are being required to enforce not only the American idea of intellectual property, but also the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You're required to enforce the DMCA in your country as a condition of healthy trade, and you'll be held in contempt of trade if you don't do that. And that's a really frightening thing for open source. It should be frightening for you. If you didn't know about that before, you should find out about it. You should, oh, how many of you have given your dues to the EFF? Everybody paid their EFF dues this year? Do you know what I'm talking about? The Electronic Frontier Foundation is the only lobbying organization that is saving the net freedom that you depend on for open source development space. They do it around the world. They do it on a shoestring. And you owe them money. If you use the net, you owe them money. And we're talking low levels of money, $10 a person. If everybody gave them as much money as they paid their cell phone provider this year, or even this month, they would be able to do so much more. So they fight the DMCA, and they fight this kind of legislation, and you guys should be thinking about it. All right. Notice self-determinism down there at the bottom. This is a huge motivator in the developing world. This is tied up with the WTO agreement thing. Because a lot of these countries don't see how they're going to be able to maintain the requirements of the WTO agreements. Some of them are not signing them, like Brazil. And they're assuming that they are going to run into trouble sometime in the next short period of time. And they're assuming that they might find themselves in the position that Cuba has been in for the last many years, where they got embargoed. And all of a sudden, their access to all kinds of things that people need was severely limited, like software. What if you suddenly got embargoed and you couldn't get North American software? Well, if you knew that was likely to happen and you were a prudent governor, you might decide to build your own before that happens. And that's a lot of what's happening in countries like Brazil. So, and also in emerging economies like China, where they know, I mean, there are 1.3 billion people in China. They have, just on their own, a huge economy, and they know they've got enough weight to drag the rest of the world in a certain direction. And so they're making choices based on their desire to see a certain outcome that helps China maintain or assume its place in the world of power. Keep your eye on China. It's going to be very interesting to watch. We've all been worried about India for so long because they're supposedly taking all the tech jobs. You've got to watch China. China's a very interesting country. Okay, here's a nice picture of Kofi Annan. Remember, I gave this to the UN, but this was not developed for the UN. This is Kofi saying, now is the time that we need to think about people's rights to technology. How many of you guys know that there's WSIS, the World, I always get this wrong, World Summit on Information Society, I think is right. It's a two-year process. This is the first time that the UN has ever split an issue into this long a consideration period, partly because they knew that they weren't technologists, they're politicians, and they didn't necessarily understand it well enough to make decisions, right? So they wanted to learn. There was a meeting in Geneva in 2004, and there's very late 2004, and there's a meeting in Tunisia late in this year. And then sometime next year, they'll come out with their declaration on the rights of man with respect, rights of people, human rights, with respect to access to technology, which is kind of a big deal. Now, you may not know that I actually worked in the American Peace Corps as my very first job out of college. Now, it might not be surprising to you if you spent time with me. What the Peace Corps did was, it was a Kennedy thing. They went off to, and it still exists, although it's different than it was when I was in it. But you go to developing nations because on the theory that Americans are so wealthy, that if we don't share at least knowledge, there's something morally wrong with us, right? And so they enlist people who wanted to help, take them to some developing country, drop them off, and you know, they always call it the toughest job you'll ever love. Because the theory was you'd get dropped off in a hut with no electricity, and you know, Peace Corps paid you very minimal amounts of money. And then you had a job, right? Well, my job was teaching English in Morocco. People don't need to learn English in Morocco. People need to learn how to better their lives, and learning English does not necessarily take you there if you're an agrarian society. When I got to Peace Corps Morocco, and Peace Corps is not in Morocco anymore, when I got to Peace Corps Morocco, it had been going for 20 years, And what we were really effectively doing was creating a picture of a certain lifestyle by teaching English and coming from these glamorous places like Los Angeles, California. And note that TV was happening, everybody was watching Dallas every night. They all wanted to be like that. They were leaving their agrarian society, moving to Casablanca, looking for work. And Casablanca was a slum. There was enormous, horrible barrio things all around, ghettos all around, because there were not enough jobs. So it was a pipe dream, right? Now, why were we doing that? Well, because it's a complicated situation, and it wasn't what the US wanted, it was what the king wanted. The point is, I learned from that experience that you cannot help the situation through good intention. It's possible to screw up, even if you're trying to do the right thing. It is very possible that in the pursuit of access of technology, a similar thing is going to happen. The fact is, for an honorable and healthy life, not everybody needs access to technology necessarily. And if they're going to get access, it should be done in a way that isn't going to upset the whole apple cart. Because, you know, the agrarian lifestyle is frankly very honorable, healthy, reasonable, and a good thing for a lot of people. There's nothing that says everybody needs to be able to get on EasyJet to come to Slovenia to go to a conference. Now, having said that, you don't want to create a society where people who haven't been given access somehow don't get the same, I don't know, opportunities, standard of life, where standard of life is defined as their lives are good, right? So the UN has a difficult job because they have to come up with rights while not causing this problem, right? I actually met Kofi Annan. I think that he probably knows everything I just said, and I think that the UN in general probably works hard to figure out how to walk this line. I'll be in Tunisia at WSIS. Intel is going there, and I was also in Geneva for Sun. It's an interesting process. I think a lot of the results are going to be around e-governance and making government transparent to citizenry, which is always a good thing. We can all agree that that's a good thing, right? But it's going to be interesting to watch. And every meeting in the developing world that I go to these days, somebody brings this up. So I thought I'd leave it in so you guys would be aware of it. Okay, this is what we run into. And again, what we do, specifically what we do, is we help the integrators who actually provide computers to the developing world customers, often governments, sometimes large educational administrations, less often individual citizens. That doesn't seem to happen much. It's usually some big entity that's pushing an initiative. We work with them. These are the things that we're noticing are problems. So the fact that it takes a long time to teach a citizen to use a computer, if they've already learned the proprietary system, it's going to really be hard for them to learn the open system. That's just a reality. And a lot of times these projects fail because they're almost always set up dual boot. Everybody wants to be fair. They want to create choice. Certainly Intel's all about choice and being the platform of choice. So we support dual boot. What actually happens is everybody defaults to what they know. That's a big problem for open source. So there's a couple of ways to solve that. For projects like OpenOffice, you could just try to match Microsoft play for play. But if you look at the lesson of Firefox, Firefox is growing hugely and quickly over Internet Explorer by being better, simply better, simpler, more elegant, and simply better. And so my takeaway from this problem is this wouldn't be happening if it was easier to learn ours. Now, I don't know how to do easy and still be feature complete. I'm not sure how to solve that problem. I will say that the first word processor that I used was, you know, really easy. It was called VI, but it didn't do much except let you type, right? I don't know where the answer is. I think it's very interesting what Tim Bray told us about blogging software being impossible, because it is. I mean, I type HTML every time I blog. Nobody should need to know that. Certainly my mother's never going to learn it, right? So that's clearly too simple, and yet that whole phenomenon is very compelling. I don't know, but I wish
we were thinking very hard about this problem instead of just chasing the existing system. Yeah?
There's also an education strike going on today, mm-hmm. which will be relevant to what you said about how people learn open source and learn how to participate.
When is
in
that?
Open
when is it?
Well, that's a whole track. My talk is at 2 p.m. But
there you go.
I didn't mean to.
Daniel's going to talk at 2 p.m. and he's got in touch. No, that's very good. Thank you for advertising. Okay, funding. Funding's always a problem. Funding's never going to stop being a problem. There's not apparently not enough money in the world, but it's not surprising that that's a problem. Use of technology, and by this they mean fitting technology to solve people's needs. Remember the slide about why people use technology? There's still a fair amount in the developing world of, here, you need this, instead of, let me hear what your problem is and then think about what to give you to make that work. I love meeting people who are doing the second thing. And in fact, I'm working on a conference right now for sort of thought leaders in India, and I'm trying to find as many people as possible who are listening first. Because that listening thing is just not promoted enough, you know? I met a man in the Punjab who, and not using Open Office at all because it was frankly too heavyweight, he went and listened to farmers. And he spent a lot of time learning what their issues were. And then he designed an extremely elegant and extremely simple system to solve their needs. And what their specific needs were, they were having crop failures, and they couldn't find out why in time to fix the problem. So he simply gave them, he gave them a Simputer. It's one of the best uses of Simputer I've ever heard, because frankly it failed. But he gave them a very simple and very low-cost computer that they could share. They only had to have one per village. He gave them a digital camera, and a fairly brain-dead, easy-to-use digital camera. He taught them how to take a picture of the crop failure and beam that picture to Delhi, made an interface that beamed it to the government agriculture board, who then could beam back an answer. Here's what you need to do. Simple. But it revolutionized how these people were approaching this really pressing problem they had. And I mean, people were killing themselves. Literally, farmers were killing themselves rather than facing the economic problems that were going to come when they were having crop failure. So this was a revolutionary change, very simple system. The important thing is he listened first, and that's not happening enough. They want to nurture local expertise, but they're not sure how. One of the reasons that I wanted to join Intel was because of I believed that they had the resources and the will to create educational opportunities for individuals in the developing world about how to build a community, how to build an ecosystem. And a lot of what I'm thinking about working on is that. Now, I've only been at Intel for 6 months, so I'm still in the what should I do and how do I sell it to Intel mode. But one of the things I'm feeling really strongly about is education. Luckily, Intel happens to really support education because the CEO was a professor before he became the CEO, and so educational programs is kind of their special thing they like to push. And there's a good chance I'll get what I want if I can figure out how to say it properly. Participation. This is the one I've been talking about to all of you guys. I hear this over and over again. We did all these changes to Open Office in order to make it work for us. How the heck do we share these back in a way that they care? Or that they even listen to us. Because you know, we've sent emails and we're not hearing back. Now, I worked at Sun. I'm not faulting the Sun engineers. They are busy, busy people. And Sun, until recently, has not actually tasked them with making the community work, except for just a couple people. And those couple people have had kind of a hard road to hoe. But it sounds to me like it's starting to change. I hope that's the case. I want to keep bringing this message until it becomes clear, and I've got to. Because I think this is the key, at least for Open Office, to making a better experience to this developing world, is letting them figure out how to participate. It may be that that means creating satellite universes. It may be it's too hard to embrace a Chinese universe, and instead of just a native language project, there should be an entire code base that they run with. I'm not sure. I don't know that that's the answer. I think one code base is generally a better idea, but we are talking about a really big global problem and a very limited number of developers to resource that problem, and I don't know what the answer is there. And then they want sustainable market models, and by that they mean business models.
Nobody wants to take on open source without setting up a business that's going to turn a profit locally. I mean, nobody. Because they think it's all going to fall apart like a cheap suit if it doesn't happen that there's a way to sustain it. And I think that's really good for the developing world because it means that they can create ecosystems. It's an incentive to do that. But they have to be taught, they have to be shown what will work and what won't work. Or we will have an awful lot of misuse without contribution back.
I spend a lot of time trying to preach that participation is ownership.
Okay, this is the obligatory slide, must be in here, where I talk about platform of choice. I said it before, I'm going to say it again. Intel doesn't sell open source. My group doesn't sell open source. What we do is meet customer need. When a group has already decided that that's what they want, we help it be a good experience. And this is sort of our credo, the way that we think about it. We provide developer tools. Right now, in my opinion, they're not quite open enough. We're pushing that, huh, Michael? Because as we know from the experience of Sun, developers don't actually spend money on tools. And so trying to make money off of tools is silly, right? If you really want them to be used. But we do have a fine set of developer tools. Those of you who went to just talk about optimization can see how some of the tools that we are working hard on making the ecosystem work and the community work and showing up there wherever we can. That's clearly why they hired me. And then we're trying to make GNU Linux, I put that in there because Richard was with us, GNU Linux easy a platform to use on IA architecture as possible, and that means pushing for drivers that are released simultaneously with each new kernel release. That means producing readiness kits that distribute those drivers directly to people that are going to use them. We recently picked up support for Debian, so not just the vendors, also the communities. So that's kind of where we're at. This is a quick picture of who's doing what in the world. I apologize for the crummy graphics, and we have got to fix this, Mike. Okay. So here in North America and Europe and Western Europe, we have leadership. We have new projects starting. We have innovation. We have people seeing open source as a business model that you want to start with, not just that you start using the software, but you actually write software for this purpose. And this is where it all started, right? I don't know if you can see that's a different color, but you can see the hatching. Brazil is approaching this state. They are committed contributors. They are parts of the open source community that have been taken over entirely by Brazilians, and they are now conducted in Portuguese. It's interesting to watch. There are a couple famous projects that have been kind of co-opted by the Portuguese, and they're pushing it a lot further than it was happening before. And the originators of the projects have no idea what's going on because they can't read the mail list. It's fascinating to watch. Brazil has a mission because they are refusing to sign the WTO agreement. They believe they are going to have to build their own universe, and that's what's going on. By the way, largest open source conference in the world, FISLE in Brazil, it's happening next year in April. It was in June this year. Almost 5,000 people and actual government-funded media events around open source software, free and open source software, because they're really in the Free Software Foundation. Very interesting. If you get a chance to go, it'll be interesting for you. And they run half the tracks in English. Okay, now, South Africa and Australia are at the part where they're doing a lot of contributing back of, you know, fixes and bugs and stuff, but they're not providing leadership in terms of thinking about how to use open source software to transform. Now, they happen to not be developing countries. South Africa may be sort of on the edge of developing. There are parts of South Africa that are every bit as developed as Europe. And the parts that aren't so developed are not getting the benefit of this work yet. And in Australia, likewise, they do have Aborigines. There are parts of Australia that need development, and yet most of the business that happens on the coasts, and their software industry is flourishing. There's a very good conference called LinuxConf.au. That is the other influential Linux kernel conference. There's one in Ottawa everybody knows in June that's been going on for a long time. The other one happens 6 months later in Australia, and it's an extremely influential conference. And so, you know, they've carved out at least that much space for themselves, and they are contributing in major ways. And now here's the problem. Asia and
Russia are just not showing up yet as contributors. They're using open source software. Between India and China, we're talking about 2.5 billion people who are using open source software but not creating anything. And it actually, what we know is there's a lot of creation going on, but it's happening behind closed doors and they're not showing anybody else what they're learning. And so nothing's getting better as a result of their work. And the people in North America and Western Europe who do the work are getting tired, because that's a huge customer base to have to deal with, right? If this movement is going to take hold, this situation has got to change. Either China or India have to come online as contributors and not just users. Now, the interesting thing, if you asked me to bet, 2 years ago I would have bet that Malaysia would be the first Asian country that really got open source, but they've been stalled a little bit. And in fact, just today there's a Slashdot story about Malaysia and where they're at with public sector use of open source. Not going so well there. The forces of proprietary software do show up whenever a major market decides to take this experiment. Proprietary software shows up, you know, with a begging bowl, essentially, saying, how can we win you back? And it's a compelling story because this, you know, there's a lot of money on that side of the table, right? And remember what I said earlier, our software is harder to use still. So those two forces are combining to create some problems. There are markets that are small enough that nobody cares, and distinct because nobody speaks English. So because they're small, there's no localization yet, and OpenOffice shows up with a localization. And because they don't speak English, that localization is key. There are still some seeds where this is clearly going to take hold, and Brazil is, again, a country to watch, because they're not going to change their mind. They've made their bed, they're going to lie in it. It'll be very interesting to watch that happen. But something has to change in Asia. And notice that I've left Africa out completely. There's not a lot happening there. A little bit. There's a early next year, there's a conference in Africa, which I'll be going to. There is a group that is trying to use OpenOffice, in fact, to do content management system for about 6 countries in Africa. The people that are doing it are in Sweden and Switzerland. It's an aid program. It should be very interesting to watch that happen as well. But right now, you know, things get dropped in and you never hear back about what's happening in Africa, because their problems are so basic that, you know, they're not doing a lot of reporting out, unfortunately. I'm sorry? Where is the conference? It's in Kenya. Yeah. Okay. So, sort of a recap, but these are some of the things that we have Intel has ended up doing. So obviously, we spend a lot of time helping these governments figure out what policies they should be adopting. And we don't tell them. We actually try to match them up. We try to find a government that has maybe made a decision and is trying an experiment, and match them with a government that's on the fence. They've made a decision, they want to do something, but they don't know what to do. Not that they don't know whether to do open or close, because if they weren't thinking open, we wouldn't be talking to them in the first place about this. But we pair them up and try to let them help each other, rather than Intel being, you know, the great savior of these companies, because that's just not how they want to set it up. They really want to teach them how to fish rather than giving them fish. And build community. So we're spending a fair amount of time trying to hook up the different governments to create community. And we're doing that in concert with the UN and some other organizations that are showing up in the same space. We're very interested in Linux deployments, and especially Linux deployments that we can point to explain to Intel why this is important. Because the leadership of Intel gets it, but there is a whole middle layer. We're talking about 95,000 people. There's a whole middle layer that doesn't get it. And it's the same thing that happens when someone from India comes up to me and says, why are you taking all the money out of the system, right? It's the same idea. Well, why would you give it away if you didn't have to? They don't understand that you now have to. These companies are being forced to show up in open source by customer demand and by the actions of other companies in the ecosystem. Since that forcing function is there, we might as well do the best job we can of it. right? So we show up doing Linux deployments. We're very interested in, if you ever hear through your open office dealings of a deployment that could use Intel help, by all means try to tell us about it. There's a chance that we'll show up there, especially if we can point back at it to Intel and say, see, this many units were tied to this work that we did. That's why we should do this. Right, so we have to justify. Intel is a company that requires a bottom line justification. We're getting involved in solution centers, and this is actually a pet peeve of mine. I believe that right now there isn't a single solution center or competency center that's been set up anywhere in the world that is worth anything, because they are all teaching a specific set of features. So if a given company sets up through an MOU with a developing government a competency center, what they're in fact doing is teaching them to use their software. And they're using it as a sales tool to push their ideas. What they're not doing is helping them learn how to make their own choices and giving them skills instead of features. It's a nuance, it's a tough thing to do. I'm really committed to trying to convince Intel to do this somewhere in the world. And a few people are hearing me, so I'm hopeful that we'll get to do one of those, at least one. We're doing a roadmap of what governments are doing, what projects, and that map that I showed you earlier is hopefully going to get much more beautiful. I'm trying to get a map that I can overlay different analysis on, like who's got policy. Wouldn't that be interesting to see? Where are they with their implementations? You know, how many units have actually shipped? How many of them are defaulting back to a Windows install? And all kinds of stuff like that that would be interesting to know. And then we're working hard to help people understand how to build out their local ecosystems. The next two slides are again, more marketerish than I usually am, but these are examples of stuff that Intel's been involved with. Let's see if I can give you an interesting one. Well, ICT People's Project in Thailand, half a million, I think, computers that the government is shipping. Over the next 10 years or something like that. It's a lot of computers. What happens is they come to us and they say, or usually the they is an integrator who's taken a tender and has said, you know, I could win this bid, but I'm going to need the following three or four pieces of help, right? And so we show up and try to make that help happen. We also show up in the country. VPs do photo ops. You know, we try to do what we can to build interest in addition to helping technically. And these all happened before I got to Intel, so let me see if there's one that I know a lot about. Well, I think the online stamp is actually a really interesting one, because that's a non-developing country that has made this choice, and we showed up to help the postal system figure out how to sell stuff online, you know, make it the best possible experience that they could experience using open source pieces, because they'd already made that choice. And here's some more, and this, let's see if I know, oh, I know a lot about Maya Pradesh. That's a place where it's a very poor part of India. I mean, as poor as India is, Madhya Pradesh is the poor part of India. And they got involved in putting computers into schools and provisioning them with an open source stack. And what they found was that kids who were going through this program were then going home and talking to their parents about it, and the parents started coming to the school to learn too, which is just a beautiful thing, right? By the way, what my current analysis about why there isn't more participation in Asia, one of the big limiting factors is nobody has computers at home. They go to an office, they use the computer that is an appliance in the office. They go home, they might not even have real electricity, much less a computer, right? And so when are they gonna hack? There's no time for that. And it's a big problem. I think that's going to have to change before anything else around participation changes. And luckily, I work for a company that's, you know, working hard to put computers in people's hands. And there are other companies that are trying to do that as well, like the MIT one that we know about. All right, we're going to go past this one to this. Is that duplicative? Well, it shows some of the brands that we've been involved in. These ones in the corner, we've done a lot of deals with Novell, we've done a lot of deals with Red Hat. We've actually done a fair number of deals with other fellow travelers. We've been involved with HP, with IBM, pretty much anybody who comes to us and is shipping an Intel CPU can expect to get some kind of assistance, right? one of the things that I spend a lot of time thinking about is how to fix the driver problem for everybody, because, you know, it's still a big problem. Who ought to be on this list is Debian, which increasingly we're seeing in the developing world, customers choosing Debian. That's because they're talking to Brazil, because Brazil chose Debian, and they did that because they didn't want to be paying money to any multinational North American-based company, whether they were selling Linux or not. So, and so the big places we play are helping people with policy, helping people with e-governance solutions like WSIS is going to provide, helping people with education, and helping people with digital inclusion or putting computers in people's hands. These are the big initiatives that we're interested in, and it's easy for us to have conversations about developing nation initiatives that are heading in these directions, because this is what we care about. And we are also committed to working together to find better ways to create solutions about content. And that's kind of a new thing that we're thinking about. I left this slide in. This is actually the logo of a government forum that I was the MC of in June. I begged my former employer for years to create this kind of opportunity for government, and to no avail. And in the first 3 months that I was at Intel, I was hosting one in Bangkok. It was a really big deal. We're committed to doing at least one of these events a year, and we're trying for every 6 months. We've created a wiki for them. It's not a public resource, and that's because, unfortunately, a lot of these folks have to balance their desire to show up in the open source space against the desire to not piss off the traditional provider. And so they're not talking about their involvement as much as we might like to see them do. And so they're speaking amongst themselves. We're hoping that will change over time, but that's the reality of where we are with that. So the summary slide, and I'm probably on time or over time at this point. First of all, it's important, it's very important, I believe, to have technology continue to be a global commons, and that means all the customers starting to be participants on some level. It doesn't have to be code contributions. There's a lot of other worthy things that need to happen to make the whole ecosystem happen. Providing decent support everywhere in the world is a huge thing. And look, it also builds local infrastructure, local ecosystem. It's a great place to start. There are a lot of developing countries that already have certain skill sets that can be turned into businesses. So for instance, call centers in India and the Philippines could be repurposed as support centers very easily. The fact that the Philippines is very good at technical documentation could be turned into an interesting business. There are a lot of things that are, without changing much, could really be done here. And we spend a lot of time trying to help make that analysis happen. It's possible for companies that are publicly traded and NGOs to work together to solve some of these problems. A lot of it depends on how that public company approaches the opportunity. There have been a lot of cases where the temptation to maximize profit has gotten in the way of really serving the community. And that's going to continue to happen, but I'm hopeful that object lessons about that not being the way to do things are going to stick eventually. By the way, there are other companies doing really good work. HP has done some amazing work creating last mile digital availability, broadband availability, and things like that in places like Africa. So, you know, it's not just Intel doing good work, and there are pockets of good work in all the big companies. It's really important for the individuals in the developing countries to understand that participation equals ownership, and that this is a bootstrap effort. It's not an entitlement program. I think countries that understand that are going to get there first. Countries that really don't get open source tend to already be rich, whether they think they are or not, like Singapore. Just goes right over their heads because they've got enough money to pay for the proprietary system. It's going to be a long time before North America gets open source deeply. Last week I was debating somebody from CompTIA, which is a think tank, about software that has taken a pro-proprietary stand. And it was interesting because the people who asked us to debate were the government of the state of New York.
because the Massachusetts decision is going to ripple through North America. It's going to be interesting to watch that.
So let's see, is there anything else there? Oh, if you want to help Open Office today, and I say this every time, hand out CDs to your government, to your church, to your school. Share. Don't be so worried about personal gain, because a strong intermesh set of sharing will in fact make us more fault tolerant to attacks that might happen from proprietary concerns, right? Let's not forget what Gandhi said. First they laugh, then they throw rocks, and then you win. We're at the throw rocks part. And you have to hold solidarity. We have to believe that this is really possible, that it's really going to come about. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but don't forget, you have to share.
I think that's it. So I have no idea if I have time for questions, but if I do, I'd be happy to take them.
Where are we with time? Does anybody know?
God. It's all right.
So, but there's all these people here for the next talk also, which is problematic. I don't want to step on the next speaker. Is the next speaker here?
Yes, it's Martin.
Is it Martin? Martin, do you hate me yet? You want to come and set up, and I'll do some questions while you're setting up. Okay. Thank you all. Who's got a question? Anybody? Maybe I don't need. You guys have not been a very questioning group this week. No. Everybody think? Yeah. Max. That's good, because you can ask me anytime.
Yeah. So you talked about positive factors here, driving government, but there is also, I would say, negative ones that, and I would like to get your comment on that, how what the interest way to look at when they use open source in political things for negotiation.
Yeah, so what he's talking about is there is a decided tendency among certain factions to use the availability of open source as a bargaining chip with the proprietary software manufacturers. Right. Well, 2 years ago, every time I spoke in a government, somebody would come up to me afterwards and say, "We really love this idea, but how can we do this for our populace without advantaging our neighbor to the north, south, east, or west, who we don't like very much?" So in India, they didn't want to help Pakistan. In Malaysia, they didn't want to help Singapore. And I mean, there was one everywhere. And it just doesn't work that way. This is a human movement. It's an all boats will rise kind of thing. I do believe there's an opportunity for the first countries. First mover advantage still counts for something. You know, everybody goes to Extremadura now. You're going there next week. Are you tired of hearing about Extremadura? Probably so, right? The story hasn't changed substantially in the last year or so. But they were first, and so everybody knows that they're important. And that's a lot of why Debian is going where it's going, because they chose Debian. So there is something worth the first mover advantage, but I agree with you, there is a fair amount of negativity. I think it's important to hold a positive space. What else can you do? It's worked for me in the past. To continue to look for people who are being as honest as they need to be to actually tell the story. It's important that the city of Munich and hopefully the state of Massachusetts, when they document their experience, are documenting the good and the bad, because not doing that, it limits us. If all you ever hear is the upside, everybody knows that it can't really be that easy, right? So. I don't know if that answered your question, but I hope so. You ready?
Take the
mic. Thank you very much for your time.
I'll pick all this stuff up later, if it's okay with you.